And I saw it and got hooked, told my boyfriend at the time, and he said, oh yeah, that's easy. I have a hunting dog. You should come hunting with me. So then I went hunting, I went duck hunting with him. We had a fabulous time. I shot a mallard drake on my own, and he let me send his dog to go get it. And that was really, yeah, that was probably, it was all downhill. It was the moment I saw this big black lab charge through the timber, pick up a bird I had shot, and bring this thing back and heal and sit. And I'm just, I think my mouth was just open. And he said, take the bird. I said, just put my hand on it. He said, yeah, and tell him drop. Okay, drop. And I'm holding this bird, looking at this gorgeous dog, thinking, okay, I need one. I need a black lab. That's next.
Hey, bird dog babes. My name is Courtney Vashon, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here with you to share the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world. I'm mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, breeding, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Bronco Italianos. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Today we are talking to Lauren Hayes, who along with her Labrador Retriever Fox won the 2019 National Open Retriever Championship. Lauren is a breeder, owner, trainer, handler, and judge, and she is the third woman in history to win this highly competitive National Open. I broke this interview up into two parts, so be sure to subscribe to this podcast to get notification when part two gets released, because we get into Lauren and Fox's intense week at the championship. Today we're going to listen to part one, where Lauren shares her story on how she got into dogs, her education, and she goes through the basics of AKC retriever hunt tests and field trials, and what to expect on the road to earning a championship. I really enjoyed talking with Lauren. Her passion for the sport, her love for her dogs, and her sheer toughness as an animal behaviorist that works mostly with canine aggression issues. I mean, come on, that is badass. And just wait till you hear what Lauren has next on her plate. Let's get after it. Thank you to our sponsor, Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for traveling to and from your favorite hunting spot. Dakota 283 kennels are a premium quality rotomold mold with recessed handles on top for convenient and safe tie down. It makes it easy to lift up into the truck. I love the secure door frame with high security locks, so I know my dogs are safe when I need to stop for fuel. An added bonus are the drain holes in the back, which make cleaning a breeze when your dog has been run hard and put away wet. Head over to Dakota283.com and enter promo code BIRDDOGBABE for a 10% discount to all my listeners. All right. Today we are talking with Lauren Hayes, the winner of the 2019 National Open Retriever Championship. How you doing, Lauren?
Hi, Courtney. I'm doing really well. Thanks. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here and happy to talk to you too.
All right. And you're coming to us from sunny Austin, Texas. Is that right?
Yes. Just hair north of Austin in Round Rock, Texas. Yes. Where it's okay. a tiny bit overcast, but a very nice warm day here.
Perfect. All right, Lauren, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came about to where you are today.
Well, sure. So probably like a lot of your listeners, I bet we could all say that we started out as little tiny humans that loved things with four legs and paws. And that was definitely me. I was raised in a great animal loving home with we had standard collies. So, you know, the lassies, and my mom and dad were great in letting us drag them around the driveway and pretend that we're training them in some way. I did a lot of that, and they were, bless their hearts, they were patient animals. And that was kind of my, actually training those dogs got me interested in competing with dogs. So I got my companion dog title with my collie named Topaz when I was 10. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Like, I worked really hard, and then I went into a little arena and got a little ribbon, and this was kind of neat.
Right. So that
was the very, very beginning of it all, actually.
Very cool. How did you learn about that? About getting started? Did you do 4-H or something? Or did you go to a local?
It was a lady named Betty Brass, and she was a high-end competitive obedience trainer who was local to our area, and she offered obedience classes on a parking lot surface at night at the local high school. And I think my mom and dad probably just wanted my sister and I to get out of the house, but we were both allowed to each take our dog and go to those obedience classes one night a week. And thankfully we were in a class with not just a instructor who wanted to teach us to have a nice pet dog. It was kind of back in the day, that would have been in 1988, 1990, where the competitive obedience world was still was more prevalent, I think, than it is right now at that level. So you could walk into a parking lot class and they were trying to prepare you to get a companion dog title on your dog. And that was the right class for me, because I'm very competitive by nature. And if I have a goal to work toward where I know that someone's going to give me a score when this is all said and done, I naturally work harder toward it. So that was a great draw for me as a 10-year-old.
Very cool. It's so neat. What a great opportunity.
It was.
So where did you go from there? After you had your first title on your dog, you were sick for it, right? Wanted to do more, get more competitive.
That's right. And then I went to Texas A&M, like fast forward to college. I went to Texas A&M and started. Well, first I was taking courses in animal science, and my sister was going to vet school there, and we each got a border collie, thinking that, you know, we probably were these great dog trainers at this point, because we had had CD titles on our dogs. So we got border collies, and mine's name was Ace, and I took Ace to, I don't know how many agility trials, agility classes, and I got really into that. While at the same time, I'm kind of forming my idea of what I wanted to do for a living, which turned out to be in the field of animal behavior. And in that progression, I met who would later be my career mentor, who was a PhD behaviorist who lived in Austin. And she said, well, you got this nice little border collie. Why don't you help me teach some obedience classes? And then you can go on some behavior cases with me. So this is all kind of gelling together with career and hobby. Mm-hmm. And so I used Ace as my demo dog in these obedience classes. I started really enjoying helping teach people how to train their own dogs. I was advancing Ace. And at the same time, during one summer, I went through a school for professional dog trainers that's right out here by Round Rock, and saw the retriever trainer there doing some things with a black lab that I thought were just mind blowing. And I don't know if you guys more in the pointing world and all the different spaniels and the beagles and the labradors and all the different facets of sporting dogs, you probably remember the moment where you saw a dog do something and you just thought, oh, what if I had a dog that could do that.
Right.
And
it gives you,
that
goosebumps.
Was kind of the, it, oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Chills. I remember watching this black lab, this female, take this beautiful, I didn't even know what an angle entry meant, but she took a beautiful angle entry on a blind through this pond, you know, re-entered 5 times, drove up this hill, sat on the whistle, took these casts. And I just thought that I don't know how in the world you would ever teach an animal to do that. And And I saw it and got hooked, told my boyfriend at the time, and he said, oh yeah, that's easy. I have a hunting dog. You should come hunting with me. So then I went hunting. I went duck hunting with him. We had a fabulous time. I shot a mallard drake on my own, and he let me send his dog to go get it. Awesome. And that was really, yeah, that was probably,
oh my gosh,
where it was all downhill, was the moment I saw this big black lab charge through the timber, pick up a bird I had shot, and bring this thing back and heal and sit. And I'm just, I think my mouth was just open. And he said, right, well, take the bird. I said, just put my hand on it. He said, yeah, and tell him drop. Okay, drop. And I'm holding this bird, looking at this gorgeous dog, thinking, okay, I need one. I need a black lab. That's next. Yeah. And that's when I got my first black lab. I found a litter, and then on it went. Oh, and I didn't even know what any sort of competition really was. I just thought, mm-hmm, I'd like to have one that I could hunt with.
Right.
And then someone said, well, you could do hunt tests, because then you could really be doing stuff all year round, not just hunting season. So I said, okay, I'll run a started test. That was the first thing I ever did. And then in UKC, and then I did an AKC junior test. And then it really, I mean, we talk about, it was all downhill from there. It was 100 miles an hour from there.
Wow. And this is while you were in getting your undergrad?
Yes. Oh, so, okay. So let's see. That was my undergrad. I finished in 2002. Okay. I went to that school for dog trainers that summer, and I started my graduate degree in the fall of 2003. Okay. So, and it took me 2 years for my master's degree. So it was actually my first black lab was born in 2002. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of when I was raising him and doing basics. And I had the opportunity to go work for two different hunt test pros while I was in graduate school, doing their force fetch, obedience, basic handling. I will forever be grateful to those guys, because I knew just enough to be dangerous. And they took me in and they showed me things, and they let me force fetch 20 dogs a day. And you just learn so much when you have your hands on dogs that love it and dogs that don't, and dogs that like you and dogs that don't really want to be there. They want to be home on the couch. And you learn how to motivate a lot of different types of dogs. And that was a huge learning experience for me.
Mm-hmm. That one training method isn't going to work for every single dog.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That sometimes when you're standing in that hot force fetch shed by yourself and you got a dog that just says, I'm not going to open my mouth, you don't always get to do the brute force method. You can't sit there and force a dog to do something and still expect them to have a great attitude. And you have to come up with a little more out of the box methods, and it stretches you. And it did. I learned a lot in those hot afternoons after class.
And so from there, you go on to get your master while you were doing the hunting and started competing as well.
So yes. So I, when I finished graduate school, I moved back to Austin to start a small business, where I now work with behavior cases. So I'm mostly vet referral only, but I work in home with people and their dogs on what has now evolved into, I'm almost aggression only. So I see dog directed and human directed aggression cases, and I work with the people and the dog in the home. So that's what I was ultimately going to do. But when I moved home, I was kind of like, what am I going to do with a degree in applied animal ethology, which is behavior work? What am I going to do with that? And especially when I had this hobby, which was hunt tests at the time, that I loved, it wasn't that time consuming. Nothing like trying to compete in the field trial world, but it was enough to where I knew I wanted to have a flexible schedule. So my first Labrador named Steel, he was about at the master hunter level by then. So I think he was maybe around his master title. And a good friend of mine, who's now a very good field trial pro named Tim Milligan, he was running hunt tests at the time. And he said, Lauren, you want to think about running a field trial with Steele. I think he could do it. I said, what's a field trial? You mean the stuff where the people wear the white jackets? No, I don't even have a white jacket. Like, I'm not going to do it. And he said, you should just try qualifying it. You know, they can be harder or easier than, you know, you might hit a good one or a tough one, but just try it. So I blame him. And I frequently tell him this to this day. It's your fault that I do this, because I agreed. I went and ran a qualifying with Steele, and I got a reserve jam, which in our world is kind of like a fifth place, but it doesn't give you any points or anything. But it's, you know, first, second, third, fourth, reserve jam, and then the rest of the jams. Well, at the time, I thought reserve jam was like, we almost didn't give you a jam, and at the last second, we decided we'll give her a reserve jam. I thought it was like last place. So when I found out it was like kind of a fifth place, I remember just, I was jumping around, squeaking, happy. It could not believe that in my first field trial, first I got this, you know, yes, I got an RJ. And I called Tim and I said, yeah, this is cool. Where if your dog does a little better work than everybody else, you get a little better placement. Like, I like this instead of the pass fail thing. And so that was the transition, like pretty much immediately from hunt tests to field trials. That was my deciding day, was the very first one I ran.
Yeah. And so have you gone back? Have you done any hunt tests since then, or did you just make the ultimate switch?
I made the switch. I believe I may, there may have been a very short time where I was transitioning because Steele was, he was so versed in the hunt test game that, he, you know, it was still really fun to go and run a master test with him. But pretty much once I started seeing that, and bless that dog's heart, man, I said, well, too bad we're running field trials. And he really stepped up to the plate in a lot of ways that he really shouldn't have. He, you know, okay, well, now we're running 400 yard marks instead of 100. Okay. He just did things. He had a ton of heart and was very forgiving, which I needed both of those at the time. Mm-hmm. And he did step up and do that. And I believe it was probably less than a year of overlap. And then my very next dog was a dog I specifically looked for the breeding that was a field trial breeding, knowing I was never gonna run another hunt test.
Mm-hmm. So for those listening that might not know the difference between a hunt test and a field trial, can you give us a quick little synopsis of that, of the difference and what kind of dog that would take?
Sure. So one of the neat things that I think is between the two sports is, I think it's a little bit more about the people than the dogs. And I say that because I have seen so many phenomenally talented dogs that never really get the shot at running a field trial because the owners are just limited by time, work, family, finances. Not that it doesn't take plenty of finances to run both, but the dedication and the lifestyle you have, I think, is almost not arguable that you have to commit harder to the field trial world because it's so hard to win. You have to be at the very top. You can't just be pass fail. Now, the dogs, if you take a pedigree from a dog that's a field champion and a pedigree of a dog that's a master hunter, they may not look any different. They might be litter mates, but it just, and they may have very, very similar talent. But the way that they, that the environment that they were put in and the chance that they had, it could have been really different. So if you have two kids and you're trying to take them to soccer games and basketball games, you're trying to do that 5 days a week, you may not have the time to be able to compete in an open unless you have the dog with a pro. So there may not be a huge difference in the dogs. I know it may be the very upper ends, you know, if you have a field champion bred to a field champion, it's very unlikely that those puppies would go to a home that says, hey, I just want a nice master hunter, go hunting with on the weekends. So there at that kind of higher percentile, you might see a difference. But hunt tests overall, Shorter distances, not competitive, so pass fail. Although I would say that I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and she said about 30% of the dogs that run a master national pass. So that's tough. That's a, you know, it's a pretty tight wow. passing margin. It's not easy to pass. So it's not like saying you can do really shabby work and still get a pass. I think the quality of work is still, there's a nice standard for that. Mm-hmm. It's just that there's not first, second, third, and fourth given.
Right.
And then, like I said, the distances, I believe the AKC has changed that the maximum distance for a mark in the hunt test world might be like 120, 30, 40, 50 yards. And if in our world, the field trial world, the marking is limited only by the dog's ability to see the gun and the bird and hear. So we've had birds that are, as the crow flies, 600 yards. You know, just not that that's
incredible.
the best way to test marking. I don't believe that it is, but it is still, no, there is nothing in the rule book that says you can't have it over 300 yards or something. So a little bit different there too. And I believe also the blinds are judged a bit of a wider corridor in hunt tests, a little tighter in field trials, because my blind, I'm trying to make my blind look better than the next guy and make it really tight, really smooth, really enjoyable to watch it and not just get the bird. I'm trying to think of some other differences. They do some other things too that are much more similar to a hunting situation. Field trials, I think there's not too many people that would tell you that it looks anything like anything you'd see in a hunting situation anymore. It's so vastly different.
Okay. So what would be an average number of dogs in a field trial that you'd be competing against?
So if you take something like the circuit that I run is mostly the Texas circuit. And in the spring in Texas, our trials can get easily 85 to 100 dogs in an open. In an amateur, I'd say a big amateur would be 85, 90. With more people, more clubs trying to create more conflicting trials, which is great, it would be more like a 70 dog open and maybe a 55 to 60 dog amateur. That would be about typical for our spring season.
Okay. That's incredible. And they give out four placements.
That's right. First, second, third, and fourth. First being in the all-age stakes. So there's two all-age stakes and two minor stakes on a field trial weekend. And the open and the amateur are both all-age. And the qualifying and the derby are the minor stakes. So in a derby, dog has to be less than 24 months old. In a qualifying, they can be any age, but they can only win a qualifying twice. So if you get two blues in the queue, you're kicked out and you have to go run the all age. And to get qualified all age, which is a title, QAA, you have to get a first or a second in any qualifying you run. And then derby points for the young dogs, the national derby list, to attain that, you have to have 10 points to get on it. And the point system is a tiny bit different. First is 5 points. Second is 3. Third is 2. And fourth is 1. Whereas in the all age, so in the amateur and the open, first is 5. Second is 3. Third is 1. Fourth is half. So it's a little bit of a different, a little bit of a different point scale. And then in the amateur and the open, if you're an amateur like me and you are running in the amateur against nothing but amateurs, and you're also running in the open against pros and amateurs, any points that you get in the open also count for your amateur field champion title, which you're trying to get, which is 15 points, 5 of which have to come from a blue ribbon. So if I win an amateur and then I get an additional 10 points in either the open or the am, I get my AFC title on the dog.
Okay.
And if I could have also won an open and gotten all my points in the open, and it would still count to the amateur field champion title. This might be more than you want to know.
No, it's good.
And for the open title, the field champion title, you do have to win an open.
Okay.
And you have to have the 5 additional points. So okay. It's a total of 10, 5 of which have to come from a blue ribbon. And then we're always trying to qualify for the nationals each year, which there's the national amateur in June, except for this year, and the national open in November.
Okay. So somebody that's, are you going every weekend when field trials are season is going on?
Well, I try to run between probably, let's see, what did I do last year? I try to run between 13 to 18 trials a year. Okay. It would be great if I could run 20. I really can't afford to, and I can't with, mm-hmm. Taking off time for work. But right. if I can try to run somewhere around 12, 13 trials a year, I feel like that's going to give me a good chance to qualify. And as my field trial mentor, Bill Eckert, said, you have to throw out about half the trials you run for judging, for poor judging, unfortunately. So if mm-hmm. you run 20, you really get 10 shots, 10 fair shots. Mm-hmm. And so that's about what I try to do. The pros, they're hitting 20 a year, a lot of them.
No!
There's the Amazon guy.
Hey, guys.
Hey. Hey, Colfax.
Is Fox Colfax back there?
Yes, yes.
Good. Fox. I'm glad he could join us on this podcast about him.
Oh, yes. He's participating in the woofing.
Too funny.
Fox. Come here, bud.
So how long could somebody figure that their dog would be on the circuit to finish its championship? If you're doing an average question. Of maybe 15 a year.
That's a great question. And I think it's so dependent on who's handling the dog mm-hmm. and the dog. That we kind of have a thing. We talk about, this dog, he's good. He might end up being a 7-year-old field champion.
Okay.
Meaning he's going to start his career in the all age, we would assume sometime around late in his second year or early in his third year. And if he's nice, if he's staying on track, you would love to be running the all age for sure. By the time they're 3, you might start a little bit earlier if they're showing a lot of promise, but we go, yeah, he might be, he's good. He's more like a 7-year-old field champion. Mm-hmm. And then, or a 6 or a 5. And then you have the superstars that are FC, AFCs by the time, while they are still 3 years old. And that kind of,
wow.
So it's in that range. And so much of it depends on, who trained this dog? How do they really understand the work? Are they really talented? I mean, are they able to get to birds that other dogs just can't get to? Or is the handler getting them to the fourth series regularly? Because you have to be in the fourth to win. And the second and third series are the land blind and the water blind typically. So are you getting the dog to the point where he has the chance to show off in the fourth on the water that he's a good marker? And so much of that is, it's just almost too hard to say. And even where you run, are you running against the top 10 dogs in the nation where some of the hardest competition is? And every weekend you're trying to beat the last national winner or the Purina winner. Are you trying to beat those dogs every weekend? Or are you in maybe a smaller population where you are the big dog in town and nobody can touch you? So sure. it might really be different.
Okay.
Depending on all those different things.
And in field trials, you're being judged by a team of how many judges are there?
So 2 judges on the weekend and then 3 at a national.
Okay. So in a competitive venue, the winners are determined on the judge's opinion, whereas in a hunt test, it's a pass or fail. So
yes,
it all depends on what that judge is looking for. So you could see a judge on the panel that you know just doesn't like your type, your style of dog, and so you would go somewhere else. Is that typical? I'm thinking in other competitive venues, that can be a common thing. Is that?
Yeah, for sure. That's true. Mm-hmm. So it might be something like, let's say you have a dog that runs a very methodical, slow blind, but that's just not that he's doing anything wrong or he's giving you cast refusals, but he's a little bit slower, or maybe even quite slow, to the point where some judges would say, well, that's displeasing. Like, I don't like to watch that. A stylish dog that's really hard going, even if he's a little looser on his corridors, a little looser on his casting, they like that better. So yes, you would definitely say, yeah, you know, if you've got this type of dog, this might be a better judge to run under, as well as pet peeves they have. So certain judges are very, they really focus on line manners. They really want to see a dog that, you know, comes to the mat right at heel, sits down, doesn't move their feet, doesn't make a sound, watches all the birds, you know, is very perfect with their mouth on the bird. And then you have other judges that say, as long as they're not doing anything egregious on the mat, I really want to see, my winner and loser are going to come from what I see in the field. And and if you know that, so if you have a dog that has a line manners issue, you know, you've got a creeper or a noisy dog, or you have anything like that, you might be more cautious about running under a judge who's going to be, you know, really taking it to you on that versus a guy that says, nah, you know, I don't mind if they creep. You know, as long as it's within this kind of range, it's fine. As long as if he's the one that's marking the birds today, he's going to win under me. So you do get a lot of that. You get a lot of opinion. And it's kind of one of the things that I find myself saying to my fellow competitors a lot is, when you feel like you didn't get a good break, like you feel like you really disagreed with a judge's opinion on your dog's work that day, you still, at the end of the day, you agreed to run under two opinionated and flawed human beings, just like I'm opinionated and flawed. And I agreed when I paid my money that I said, okay, I'm going to run under two human beings. And if it doesn't go my way this time, maybe it'll go my way next time.
Yeah, and it's sometimes, an opinion.
Yes. And sometimes I know people that keep lists. They have very, very stringent lists. They will not run under this, you know, anybody whose name is on that list, they will not run under them. That's great if you have the luxury to travel to avoid those. I don't really do that. I kind of think if my dog wins and he blows it out of the water, they can't take it away from you. So if they really win, they really win. And I also can't say, well, I'd rather drive 6 hours to not run under this judge. So I don't really do that, but I can understand the sentiment.
Right. And afterwards, do you get to find out from the judges of maybe why they liked your dog or why they didn't place your dog? Is that a normal thing, or is it just you get what you get and you go home?
So I think that there's definitely two schools of thought on that. I know handlers that will ask, and they ask in a really nice way at a later date, usually not the same day. If you have a question about whether or not you were called back, you have to go through the marshal, sort of as the intermediary, so that you don't have contestants confronting judges and stuff. But that would be during the trial. Like, so are you sure number 25 wasn't supposed to be back? Then the marshal asks the judges. The judges say, yes, no mistake, he's not called back. And then some judges will say, yeah, he was really wide left of the point in the water that we wanted the dog on. And so the judges kind of try to give a little helpful feedback as to why the dog's not back. That's just a judge's discretion.
Okay.
But when the trial's over and the placements are done, the way that I know that most people do it is, they're friends, you know, it's a small world. A lot of us are friends. And mm-hmm. they would maybe feel comfortable later on saying, hey, so just curious, you know, I thought I had a really good last series. I got a third. I noticed that the two dogs that placed in front of me, they had hunts. You know, can I learn something from why I didn't do better? And then the judge might graciously say, oh, well, it's because, you know, we had to talk about it, but you had a hunt in the first series. You had two cast refusals on the lamb blind and it was close, but those two were ahead of you. And so it might be, you can definitely ask, it needs to be done in a really, a thoughtful, sportsmanlike, and in a way that comes from a place of a desire to learn and not a desire to confront. I find that a lot of judges will be really honest with you if you come at it like that and not mm-hmm. in a, so what's up? 2 weeks ago, I totally had that one. What do you mean?
Right.
You
know? Right.
So it's all about that. But I think some of the and just to say, a lot of them are women that really are trying to learn about why they didn't do well or what they can do better.
Right.
When they approach it like that, I almost don't know a judge that would not say, oh yeah, well, as long as you're not trying to just criticize my decision, then mm-hmm. I would love to tell you about what I saw and what I think you could do better on.
Fantastic. Do you judge as well?
Yes, I sure do.
Okay.
I married my husband. He was a pro, but he was only a pro for the first 3 months we were married, but I still had to wait a year to become an amateur again. It's kind of a funny rule in the AKC. Hmm. But then they make you wait 2 years to judge. So I can't judge. I judged a lot. I was an 8-point judge in the all age prior to that. So I'll still be an 8-point judge when I can judge again. But that won't be until November of this year. And I have, I'm actually pretty excited because our good friend in Alaska invited me and my husband to judge an open and an amateur, I think, together in Alaska in the summer of 21.
How
so
cool.
I'm really excited about that assignment. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Very fun. So does an 8-point judge, is that going to be in advanced? Is that what that means?
So it just means that in order to judge a field trial, both judges have to have a combined total of 8 points. So if you had four and I had four, we could judge together. Mm-hmm. My husband has never judged an all-age stake. So our first assignment, I will carry him because I'll have 8 and he'll have 0.
Okay.
So that's just the system.
Yeah.
That they have in place. And then once you've reached 8 points, they stop counting. Well, the judge doesn't stop counting. I know guys that know exactly how many points they have, but mm-hmm. you know, you could have 150 points, but you're still called an 8-point judge.
Okay. Got it. Lauren, what does the demographic of women look like in your sport from when you started to what it is now?
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think from the hunt test world to the field trial world, it definitely, there's a definite difference. I would say I saw a lot more younger women, moms with younger kids, people that kind of wanted to try this out and see if they wanted to, you know, put on mud boots and go train their dogs every weekend. I saw a lot more of that in the hunt test world.
Okay.
And for that reason, I think it's such, I think you almost can't overstate the value of having both sports, because one of them, if you wanted to get into field trials, hunt tests are a really good place to kind of see if you really like it. Mm-hmm. You get for tons of reasons, but then going into the field trial world, it seemed like there were quite a bit more retired women that have already raised kids. Now they're really enjoying retirement. They've got property up north, property down south, and they do it either with their husband or without, but they are, and it is a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I don't know too many of them that do it kind of on the side. I'd say almost all in my closest women friends in the game are heavily invested in it, that it is, it shapes every aspect of their life, from what city they live in at what time of year to, you know, what they do Monday through Friday through on Saturday and Sunday, to what they drive. I mean, everything is around it. So, which I think just reflects the time requirement difference in the two games.
Right. It'd be a difficult venue to have probably small children with, if they're coming with and toting them around, as I'm thinking with my 2-year-old and 5-year-old.
As I'm thinking, I'm 6 months pregnant. I'm sitting here thinking,
Oh, congratulations. Oh my goodness.
Thank you.
How awesome is that?
It's pretty exciting. We're excited.
Let's dive into that. So what's the plan? For pointing field trials, we're on horseback. So we have
That's so cool. I could totally get into that.
Oh, we should. Let's exchange hobbies sometime together. It'd be good.
Yes, for sure.
But you have your husband with you, and he does the dog stuff. He enjoys it. So that's gonna work well. They'll go good with you guys. If you were out there doing it by yourself, you might have more of a struggle, right?
Yes, and I have had, like, my training partners that I'm also really close friends with. We talk a lot about, okay, you know, here's a good place to put a pack and play under this shade tree. And here would be, like, I have a little backpack or little, what are they called? I don't know anything about babies. The little thing where you, like, they strap onto your chest or your back. Like, I have one of those ready to go. And I don't know a lot of women. In fact, I'm trying to think of if I know anyone right now that is really competitive, like, upper end of the game and has little bitty kids. I can't think of someone, and I apologize to anybody I'm forgetting. I'm thinking most of them have, their kids are grown, moved out. They didn't do this when they had little kids. So I know there are going to be some significant challenges to this, but I have no intention of slowing down or quitting. So
I have no doubt that you're going to be able to do it all.
I'm going to try.
Oh, you will. Oh my gosh. It'll be good. And what a great inspiration you're going to be for that exact reason of showing how you can get it done and having support system. The dog community, I think, is an amazing support system in general. And I know I found when we were at our national a couple of years ago, I had a 2-year-old and, you know, I had the buddy saddle on, so he did ride some braces with us, but someone would say, Courtney, he's falling asleep. He's starting to go off to the side. I'm like, oh geez. so then the two people working the, running the dogs back and forth in the truck, they said, oh, we'd love to take him. And sure enough, he would sleep in there and he loved riding in the truck. So the dog community, they just embrace you. And especially a baby growing, being able to bring a child up in a sport like that. It's very cool.
Oh, that's very encouraging to hear, because I'm looking forward to it. I also have a lot of trepidation about logistics of, I mean, in fact, this national amateur, my due date is July 28th and the national amateur is was going to be June 7th till it got canceled. And I had all these plans. I mean, I know I'm going to be ginormous handling in the national, but I was ready I got a nice big handling jacket. I was ready to go, but I do, it's encouraging to hear, because I think about some of my best women friends in the game and how pumped they are. And I'm like, I could like pass the baby around during the entire trial and, you know, just, I wouldn't have to do anything. I'd just run my dog.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think you're going to be surprised how many people are going to be grabbing at that baby. You're going to go, okay, where is it now?
Good. I'll be happy to. Whose truck is he in right now?
Right, right. That's so awesome. Huge congrats. Very exciting.
Thank you. Thanks. We're pumped.
I want to hear about Fox, but first let's get into the event. So he had to qualify by getting points from, is it a full year before? Are those the only points that count towards that to qualify?
Yes, you get, yes, you get a year. So from the national in November of 18 to the weekend before the national starts in November of 19. That's how long you had, and you have to get blue plus two. So you have to get a win. Okay. It has to be an open win. You can't win an amateur. You have to win an open, and you have to get two extra points. So if you get a win in a second, a win in two thirds, a win in four fourths, et cetera.
Okay. And how many did Fox have going into it?
So he had, we had a good year with pretty limited trialing. He won an open right off the bat in the spring of 19, won a 85 dog open. And I think it was the Tejas trial. I can't remember which trial it was, but he won an open right away. So there, like, all the pressure was off. And then he got a third in the spring as well. So, and this is all while I cannot run the amateur still. Like, I couldn't run the amateur until November 1st of 19. So that's one of the kind of cool things about the timing of me winning the national open was I won it as an amateur, but had the national been 1 month earlier, they would have called me a pro winning it. So I was really grateful to win it as an amateur, but because then it qualifies you for both nationals the next year instead of just the national open. But anyway,
okay.
So we got a win and a third. So I was 1 point short of qualifying when the fall season rolled around, and I took a trip to Missouri in late September, early October. I took, Glenn had to stay home. I took my three dogs and my Fox son, Koufax. I was going to bring out and try a few derbies with him. My middle child, my female, Ryan, I was going to run a couple derbies with her and then a qualifying. She wasn't quite 2 years old yet. And then I was going to try to get Fox qualified for the National Open. And the very first trial, he won the open. So we were set for going to California. And then we had a really great time. You know, the pressure was off. I had a really fun time the rest of the trip. Ryan, the female, won two qualifyings and promptly got herself kicked out of the qualifying. And Koufax got third, second, third, and three derbies he ran. So we had a great trip. And by the time we came home from that, at the end of October, we were ready to go to California.
And you took how many dogs to California with you? How many did you have qualify? Was it just Fox?
Just Fox. Yeah.
Okay.
Just Fox. Ryan rode along in the cab with Fox for moral support, but just Fox qualified. Yeah.
And you, how many dogs do you have of your own at home?
We have four, and three of them are mine.
Okay.
And Glenn's is the youngest. So he has a Fox son who's about 9 months old, I think.
Okay.
And Glenn works. He doesn't have quite as much time. His schedule's not as flexible. So he's got his, and then, and I've got these three.
I love how you say that. Because it's the same as my husband and I. We, you know, you guys have the dogs together. They're both yours, but then you have my dogs there. I have five that are mine, and he has four that are his.
and it's kind of a good system because, like, when he also had a Fox son that we ended up selling last year, but like if he had to work Monday through Friday. And I can really only train Friday and Saturday, but I try to do more if I possibly can. But I would take his dog who was getting ready to run the all age, and I would train his dog for him Friday and Saturday along with mine. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, any day that I couldn't train, I would totally trust him to train my guys, which doesn't normally go that direction. But if it did, you know, it's kind of nice. We can all the dogs will run for both of us. And of course he used to be a pro, a very good young dog pro. So he's really good with young dogs. And It's fun to kind of collaborate, especially on basics, because he's done a lot of basics. And then I have like, I'm really particular about the basics on my dogs. So we have some interesting conversations about that, but, mm-hmm. but yeah, like they're everybody's, but like, especially Fox, who I've had since way before I met Glenn. Well, not way before, but pretty much before, he's really mine. He sleeps next to me.
Do you breed as well?
Yes. Okay. I bred Fox, and I bred his father Slider, because Slider was my dog. He was a FC. He was my first titled dog, and Slider, the one that I was telling you was in the commercial. Mm-hmm. Slider was just a phenomenal dog. Like, I didn't deserve a dog like his caliber. Mm-hmm. And thanks to Bill Eckett, my mentor, I didn't ruin him, but Slider mm-hmm. was amazing. He finished 4 out of 8 nationals he ran, and he was just outstanding dog. So he got bred a good amount. And then from my favorite Slider breeding, I kept Pick Male, and that was Fox.
So when you traveled to California, and mm-hmm. how many dogs were entered in the championship?
I want to say there was like 100 dogs. I think like 99 started.
Okay.
I want to say, I feel like it was, there was like 101 entered, and there was like 2 females in season that had to scratch or something like that. I believe there was, I want to say there was 99 that started.
Okay. So they have to scratch. It's not just wait till the end of the day. If they're in season, right. They're done. They can't run.
They're done. They do bitch check. Yeah. Oh, and especially if you drove all the way out there, but they,
right.
You know, you go out early, you do a week of pre-national training, you get all ready. And then the night before the national starts, like right after we finish the meeting where they do the draw to pick who starts, they do bitch check, and they line up every single female competing. And if your dog's in season, you can't run. Mm. Very disappointing. Yes. Yeah, those girls, they're heartbreakers. Yeah.
So how many of all those, of the 99, how many were teams, with women?
What a good question. I can go get my book if you want me to look up the
That's
number.
Okay. I was just guessing, like, maybe an approximate.
I'm going to throw out a wild guess here, and I'm going to say I'm going to say 15 women handlers.
Okay.
I'm going to guess that.
Okay.
I could be off on that, and I can check that and give you the exact number later if you want
That's
me
okay.
to, because I don't want to leave anybody out.
Yeah, it was just a curiosity question to see how many women were able to qualify and are competing.
A lot.
Just looking at the ratio of what's that?
National amateurs, there's a lot mm-hmm. more.
Okay.
Like the National Open, and I that could be a generous guess. There might have mm-hmm. been more like 10.
Okay.
10 women running total, but
okay.
Not near as many as at the national amateur, just because okay. opens are just harder to win. I mean, there are fewer men running them too. You know, it's just, they're harder to get to, harder to win mm-hmm. an open than an amateur.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. I'm so grateful you chose to hit play today. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to show your love and support of this content, become one of my Patreon patrons. As a patron, you receive more discounts, content, are an insider to the Bird Dog Babe community. In addition, 2% goes towards conservation. If you want to learn more about this episode and others, head over to thebirddogbabe.com for show notes and discount codes from our sponsors. And follow me on Instagram at thebirddogbabe. If there's a topic you'd like me to get after, go to my website and fill out the contact form, because this show is for you. Until next time, Bird Dog Babes, keep them versatile.